It's tempting to think of our minds as finished products. Our body shape, our health, these are things we know how to influence, but our emotional landscape can feel set in stone. But new research in neuroscience and brain imaging is changing what we think we know about our emotional selves. It turns out we can actually use our minds to change our brains and move towards a more balanced emotional life. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison, and he serves on the board of directors of the Mind and Life Institute, a group dedicated to promoting a dialogue between Western scientists and the Dalai Lama. He directs the Lab for Effective Neuroscience at the UW-Madison, and in 2006, Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. His new book is called The Emotional Life of Your Brain, and he authored that with Sharon Begley. And we're looking forward to hearing your questions and comments today at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org or chime in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Richard Davidson, thank you so much for joining us in studio today.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, there's so much fascinating research in your book. It really traces the evolution of what we know about how our brains and our emotions work together. But really one of the most exciting pieces of information there is that we can change our emotional lives by working with the brain. So can you tell us why that idea is pretty revolutionary?
Well, our brains are constantly being influenced, wittingly or unwittingly, by the forces around us. And one of the things that modern neuroscience has taught us is that the brain is plastic. The brain can be influenced by experience and by training. And this leads to the possibility that we can actually change our own brain, take responsibility for the shaping of our brain by being more intentional about it, by engaging in certain mental exercises to strengthen certain circuits that will promote qualities or habits of mind. And we can also take responsibility for arranging our environments in ways that will promote more optimal functioning.
Now, it sounds as though, yeah, obviously, you've been working on this for years and years, but in the beginning of your research, this was not something that was obvious to anyone. The universities that you were trying to work with, the programs that you were looking into, this idea about the emotions being housed in the brain basically made you a pariah for a long time in the beginning of your research, right?
Well, I do talk about this in my book, and I was a graduate student in the 1970s, and in that era, emotions were kind of the backwater of psychology and neuroscience, and there was relatively little research that was going on emotion, and what research there was taking the view that emotion was something that disrupted thought, that disrupted the highest form of human rationality, the idea that emotions can serve important adaptive functions was not something that was center stage in research on emotion. And with regard to the brain, most of the research at that time on the brain and emotion was relegated to research in animals at a very, very basic and primitive level. The notion that higher centers in the brain, centers that at that time were regarded as the province only of rational thought.
The prefrontal cortex.
The prefrontal cortex, exactly. And the prefrontal cortex is a chunk of real estate sort of behind the forehead, which is the most evolutionarily advanced part of our brain.
So that's the big money real estate.
That's the big money real estate. And everyone thought that that was the seat of human rationality. And to propose that this part of the brain also played an intimate role in emotion at that time was somewhat heretical.
And then you yourself were a meditator, and that didn't earn you any followers at that point either. That was something you kept in the closet because that was even more fringy at a certain point. When did you find that you were vindicated and you were showing finally that, you know what, there is emotional activity going on in these important centers in the brain?
Well, I began to do that toward the end of my graduate career, and we embarked upon a program of research where we used the methods that were available to us in that day, which were fairly coarse. We We're recording the electrical activity of the brain with sensors or electrodes that we've placed on the scalp surface to make inferences about what's going on in the brain. And sure enough, we uncovered quite a bit of evidence and published many papers around 1980 to 1995, in that 15-year period, establishing that activity in the prefrontal cortex was importantly related to certain attributes of emotion and emotion regulation. And so that body of work really helped to establish that the prefrontal cortex really does contribute to emotion.
Well, one of the things you wanted to know is how early we get this emotional, I guess, sort of a blueprint, although it's plastic. We talked about that. But how early did you find we do have these emotional tendencies, emotional styles, you call them?
Well, there are propensities which can be detected at birth. And actually, as part of the work we did in that early period, we investigated infants beginning in the newborn period 72 hours after birth. And we were able to uncover differences in the disposition of those infants that were associated with behavioral and brain changes that were also observed simultaneously. Now, having said that, it's also clear that while there are propensities that exist from the start, those propensities are importantly shaped by one's environment, by parenting styles, by other influences which occur early in life. Those influences turn out to be extremely important, we now understand, in shaping the brain, both functionally as well as structurally, and actually down to the level of gene expression, where literally the expression of our genes is influenced by environments in which those brains reside.
So in other words, like the genes can be turned off or on depending on the environment that you're in.
Precisely.
And the same happens with our emotions, you're saying.
Yes, that's true. And so our emotions are shaped by those environments because those environments will influence the circuits in the brain that are important for the regulation and expression of those emotions.
Well, you have broken down our emotional lives into six sort of categories, and these are spectrums, and most people fall somewhere on the spectrum. You yourself are on the sunnier end of things. You're one of the lucky ones. Some people are more toward the depressive end, but tell us about these six styles and how they influence our emotional life.
Sure. The styles that I talk about in the book, first of all, were not dimensions that I just sat down one day and decided to figure out. They really emerged over the course of 30 years of research. And each of these dimensions or styles is rooted in the brain. It's a product of neuroscientific research. And I'll list the styles. how we've described them in the book. A little bit about what they're related to. So one style is resilience. Resilience refers to how quickly or slowly you recover from adversity. Some people take a long time to recover after confronting a stressful event. Their negative emotions persist. Other people may show a response to that adversity, but very quickly recover. A second style we call outlook. Outlook is in many ways the flip side of resilience. And outlook refers to how long positive emotion persists. So imagine you have a really wonderful conversation with a close friend or a spouse early in the morning. How long does the afterglow last? Some people will find that their day is really colored by the an event which occurred early on that was positive. And for other people, the positive emotion is very fleeting. It turns out that among patients with depression, that positive emotion is really fleeting. So many people with depression are actually able to experience positive emotion in the moment. It just doesn't last. Third style we call social intuition. Social intuition refers to how accurate a person is in detecting the social nonverbal signals of emotion in another person. For example, their facial expressions, their tone of voice, their body posture. At one extreme are individuals in the autism spectrum who have a very difficult time decoding the facial signals, particularly of others. And they have a difficult time, therefore, knowing what the emotions are in another person. A fourth style is self-awareness. And self-awareness refers to how accurate a person is in detecting her or his own internal bodily cues of emotion. When emotions occur, there are changes that occur in our body, changes in our heart rate, in our pattern of muscle tension, and so forth. And some of us are more acutely sensitive to those cues. Others of us are really opaque to those cues. And self-awareness refers to how sensitive a person is in detecting her or his own cues. A fifth style is context. What we mean by context is how one uses context to modulate one's emotional responses. So, for example, if I have a conversation with my spouse, presumably the rules of conversation would be very different than if I have a conversation with a boss. And so being able to modulate one's emotional responses in a context-appropriate way is what's captured by this dimension. At the extreme are individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder. Imagine a soldier in Afghanistan who is in the battlefield. The changes in the body that occur in response to a traumatic event in that moment are actually very adaptive. But when those changes occur in a context that's safe, those changes can be very maladaptive. So when those individuals return back to the United States, for example, and they're in a safe neighborhood and walking down the street and an ambulance goes by and they hear a siren, sometimes that cue can trigger the full-blown response that they may have experienced during trauma because they're unable to differentiate context. The last style we call attention, and attention is not normally considered a dimension of emotion, but when you think about it, the things we attend to in our world, the things that capture our attention, are the things that are emotional. That dimension goes from being very focused and being able to resist distraction in one's environment to being very scattered and being pulled by the emotional cues all around you. And again, to summarize, each of us have all six of these dimensions, but each of us differ in where we fall on each of these six dimensions. And there's no optimal emotional style. Emotional styles will be optimal for one person in her or his context, but that might be different than what might be optimal for another person.
And that said, you'd probably be hard-pressed to find someone who didn't want to tweak something within that emotional context. And it can be easy to feel trapped in the way you respond to things, maybe think, you know, I'm someone who tends to panic and I'm more too self-aware, but would like to maybe just tweak that one spectrum. And in your book, you have exercises and sometimes meditation techniques for each of these if we want to move somewhere different on the spectrum. So how hopeful is that outlook? I guess in a broad overview, how hard is it to change where you are in one of these styles?
Well, you know, I think the most honest answer is we don't quite know at this point yet, although I'm convinced that it's easier than we think. And that's because we don't normally think about emotions and our emotional disposition as a skill. But all of the evidence in neuroscience leads us to view qualities like well-being and happiness as skills. They actually can be modulated through training. Based on everything we know, if we actually engage in systematic practice to cultivate certain habits of mind and to transform these emotional dimensions, then I think there's a lot of reason to think that we can probably tweak them in ways that are easier than most people have believed.
When we're talking about calibrating these emotional styles so that we get to a place that's more optimum for us, is the Holy Grail still happiness or is it contentment?
You know, I think it depends on what we mean by those words. I prefer the term well-being, which is closer to the Aristotelian notion of eudaimonic well-being. Eudaimonic well-being is a phrase that refers to a sense of purpose and a meaning. So it's not just hedonic happiness or hedonic pleasure, but it captures much more and has to do more with the realization of certain goals that we may have for ourselves and connecting ourselves to the significance of those goals.
Now, you have made a name for yourself, among other things, as doing lots of work with the Tibetan community of exiles, the Dalai Lama, and the monks and nuns that he works with. And they have been in your MRI machines. You've studied their brains. And I wonder what they think, what their brains look like in terms of happiness versus contentment. I mean, would the Dalai Lama say that he is happy, or would he say he has well-being, and or what the goal would be, and what would that brain look like that had reached maybe that optimum place?
Well, I think the Dalai Lama uses the word happiness in ways that I would think of as a kind of genuine, enduring happiness, which many people, I think, might use the word contentment or well-being for. And so it's not a hedonic pleasure. And the Dalai Lama has been quite clear that the sources of happiness don't lie in the acquisition of material goods, for example, but rather it's something more internal and something that can be cultivated. And yes, we have really benefited, I think, from our interactions with the Dalai Lama and with the contemplative communities, because they have taught us that several things. One is that health or mental health and well-being is not simply the absence of illness, but really is something more. That's one very important idea that they have added to the table. In the Western lexicon and in Western psychology, psychiatry, neuroscience, that really has not been a central theme. The theme has really been more on eradicating illness, with the implicit understanding that the eradication of illness was the equivalent of health. That's just not the case in that community. And the second is that their brains really, the brains of the meditators that we've studied are different. There's no question about it. They function differently, and there's now increasing evidence to suggest that structurally they're different as well. There seems to be a growing body of evidence that the systematic cultivation of these kinds of habits of mind does change your brain. We, in fact, can change our brain by transforming our mind.
There's a wonderful part in your book. You have just worked with the Buddhist monk Matthew Richard, and I think he was here at the UW, and you had him in an MRI machine, and you talk about when you're looking at his scans, how it looks as though parts of his brain cooperate with one another in incredible synchronicity that you wouldn't normally see. You liken it to rockets kicking all at once, 2,000 rockets or something like that. So what did his brain look like when you looked at that scan?
Well, there's a certain type of measurement that we take, which is based on looking at the electrical activity of the brain, but we use many, many sensors. We use actually more than 200 electrodes on the head. And we are looking at a specific parameter, which is called synchrony. And it literally is the mathematical synchronization, the in-phase synchronization of a certain kind of cortical oscillation that we can measure. So these are oscillations in the brain electrical activity that are generated in the cortex. And what we see is this massive synchronization across many different brain regions during specific kinds of meditation practices. And what it seems to correspond with in the phenomenal experience of the meditator is an experience of the vastness of space that their minds merge with when they are engaging in this kind of meditation practice, so that awareness is really acute, and there's a kind of vast panoramic awareness that is cultivated in this practice. And that seems to be the period that coincides with the expression of this synchrony that we record in these brain rhythms.
Well, that sounds pretty wonderful. Have you felt that yourself? You're a meditator.
Well, you know, I'm such a beginner, so I've gotten a smidgens of glimpses.
A smidgen of wonder there. Well, it's wonderful to hear about. And when we come back, we want to talk about some of the exercises that you prescribe for people who do want to move themselves around on these emotional spectrums. Right now, we're talking with Richie Davidson, a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison. He has a new book out called The Emotional Life of Your Brain. That is co-authored with Sharon Begley, and he is also on the board of directors of the Mind Life Institute, a group dedicated to promoting a dialogue between Western scientists and the Dalai Lama. And we'd love to hear your questions and comments. If you'd like to work with your brain, you heard Richie Davidson describing these six emotional styles. Now, if you would like to move yourself in one direction or the other, maybe you've got a question about just how to do that. Well, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. And you can always chime in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking with Richie Davidson, a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he also directs the Lab for Effective Neuroscience at the UW-Madison. He's got a new book out called The Emotional Life of Your Brain. And we'll go first to Jeff, who is joining us from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. This is absolutely fascinating me. Just a quick comment. I do training for emergency managers of humanitarian organizations overseas, and part of a major component of it is the development of emotional intelligence using the approach sort of made familiar or public by Daniel Goleman and those sorts of ideas. And I'm just wondering, I wanted to ask, there seems to be a raging debate among academics online as to whether EI, emotional intelligence, is a set of true intelligences like IQ that we're born with, or is it a basket of skills that can indeed be developed? It seems like you just said these are trainable skills, but I'm wondering, I agree with you on that, but I'm wondering why this raging debate then? What's the basis of that debate?
Well, thank you for the question. I'm actually not sure what the basis of the debate is. As far as I'm concerned, and based on the work that I know, there is absolutely no question that these are skills that can be enhanced through training. There's abundant evidence for that at this point in time. I think that when the concept of emotional intelligence was first introduced, the way the concept was described and the term that was used, emotional intelligence, implied that it may have properties similar to IQ, and predicated on the assumption that we're sort of each born with a fixed complement of emotional intelligence or intellectual intelligence, and there's really relatively little we can do about it, but certainly in the case of emotional intelligence, we now know that that's just not true. There is a movement afoot in the United States today that is based on Dan Goleman's work, and it's called social and emotional learning, and it's being introduced into school curricula throughout the U.S. There are now, I believe, 14 states in the United States where it's legally mandated that social and emotional intelligence programming be incorporated into the school curriculum in the K through 12 years. And there's a recent meta-analysis. This is an analysis of many studies that involves more than 280,000 school children throughout the United States that unequivocally demonstrates that these skills can be enhanced through training. The evidence is incontrovertible at this point in time.
Do you consider emotional intelligence maybe a collection of these styles that you talk about? I mean, I can imagine emotional intelligence being a product of where we are in the self-awareness scale or the social intuition scale, things like that.
Very much so. So emotional intelligence is a more global kind of concept that is based upon where a person is on each of these six styles.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call. And we move next to Ken, who's joining us in Oshkosh. Hi there, Ken.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate the gentleman's work in this field because we do need to really focus on mind. That is supposedly one of our greatest tools in living within this world. But I just wondered if the gentleman had ever, and I would suggest that he did if he didn't, got involved with neurolinguistic programming. It was done by Bandler and Grinder, Gestalt therapist, and a computer programmer, and it was aided by people like Gregory Bateson, Erickson when they were alive, and its techniques, including even up to timeline techniques, are just incredible and incredibly effective.
And have you heard of that, neuro-linguistic programming?
Yes, I certainly have, and thank you for the comment. And it's certainly a very interesting and important approach. And unfortunately, it has not received that much research attention in the serious academic circles. But I certainly am well aware of it, and I share your intuition that it can be extremely valuable.
What is it?
It's really a set of tools that is based on work like Gregory Bateson's work and Milton Erickson, who is a very famous hypnosis researcher, that argues that there are certain ways in which language can be used to actually influence the mind and the brain in ways that are very direct.
For example?
Well, it's exemplified in some of the behavior change that can be achieved through verbal suggestions that are given under hypnosis, for example.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you, Ken. And let's go next to Lewis, who is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi there.
Hi. I grew up in a home where my father shouted and yelled a lot at the children. And I'm wondering what impact does that have, like, say, from a toddler on their emotions, both at the time and then in the future of their life?
So Lewis, talking about the environment there and the way it relates to emotions, what do you think?
Well, it's a very important question, and there's actually been quite a bit of research on that question. And there's no question from that work that that kind of family environment, and particularly criticism from one's parents, can affect the brain. It does affect the brain. And when that kind of family environment is cumulative over time, it can exert potentially deleterious effects. And it actually has been considered a risk factor for the development of certain kinds of psychiatric disorders and can exacerbate the symptoms of certain disorders. We know from neuroscientific research that if you put a person in an MRI scanner and play for them an audio tape, a recording of their mother or father criticizing them, it really drive certain parts of the brain crazy, so to speak. It produces tremendous activation in certain brain regions, and the possibility of that being extended over time certainly is a prescription for potentially deleterious effects. Having said all that, I think that the wonderful hope of neuroplasticity is that it's possible to reverse some of those effects by taking more responsibility for the positive shaping of our brain.
Hmm. Well, thank you. That's such an interesting question, Lewis. And it's hard to think of a more awful experiment than being stuck in an MRI tube with your mother criticizing you. Is that one of your experiments?
No, actually is not. This is done by a friend and colleague of mine at Harvard.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, let's see. Well, let's take just a quick break from these calls. There's a lot of them, but I want to talk about some of the exercises that you give in your book, One, which I thought was kind of surprising, for people who want to move themselves around on the positive-negative outlook spectrum, you suggest delaying gratification. Now, this is toward, if you would like to move, I believe, more toward the positive end of things. Why would that help?
Well, first of all, let me say a few things about delay of gratification. It turns out that differences among people in their capacity to delay gratification, it turns out to be an enormously important predictor of later adult outcomes when it's measured in children. Kids who at age 4 or 5 have a difficult time delaying gratification, when they become young adults, are more likely to be impulsive. They're more likely to have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. They're more likely to engage in substance abuse. And they actually are more likely to earn less money. So there's a whole cascade of consequences that are associated with this. So the capacity to envision an alternative future, which would be potentially more meaningful than an immediate reward in the present moment, and being able to resist that distraction is something that can be potentially very helpful in organizing one's behavior toward a longer-term future goal.
In terms of the brain, what is happening there then with delaying that gratification? What do we see when we look at the brain of a child or someone in an MRI scan?
What you see during periods of delay of gratification is that the prefrontal cortex kicks into action. The prefrontal cortex is an area very important for planning and also important for inhibiting our responses to distractors, which are immediately present in our environment. And so exercises which strengthen the delay of gratification are exercises which also strengthen the prefrontal cortex.
So you suggest training yourself to delay that gratification if you want to have a more positive outlook on life. So how would that work if you're practicing those exercises in your life? You just tell yourself, nope, I'm not going to have that piece of cheesecake until tomorrow.
Well, you know, in the book, I talk about a variety of different strategies that a person might try for delaying gratification. And what works for one person will not necessarily be what works for another person. One size does not necessarily fit all. But one of the exercises that I talk about is simple mindfulness meditation. And mindfulness meditation, or mindfulness, can be defined as an instruction which invites a person to pay attention on purpose, non-judgmentally. And the non-judgmental piece is very important because it enables a person to regard an object, for example, something that may be in her or his environment that's immediately very rewarding, and just to regard it without getting hijacked by it, so to speak. To be able to look at it and just see it as, you know, instead of seeing it as delicious food, which you want to grab right away, just notice its qualities. And that is something which requires practice. It requires exercise.
In fact, meditation is a prescription for almost all of these, for moving yourself around almost all of these emotional styles, isn't it? Different types of meditation?
I do describe a variety of types of meditation, which I think can be used to shift your set point on several of these different dimensions. And so the virtue of these kinds of practices is that they can be done anywhere. They don't require any special technology. We have all the equipment. Every human being has the equipment to do this. And it can be done in one's daily life. And so the capacity to incorporate this kind of training in one's daily life, I think, is very real using these very simple kinds of exercises.
And one thing that's especially fascinating about using meditation to change your set point is that some of these meditation techniques will move you in either direction on the spectrum, depending on what your brain needs.
That's right. And it's not necessarily the case that it's moving in one particular direction is always most optimal. Just to give one example, one might think that it's always good to increase one's self-awareness. And the way I talk about self-awareness in the book is being aware of what's going on in your own body that may be associated with emotion. But if you're so hyper acutely aware of every small change in your body, that may be quite maladaptive. And you may then start to interpret those small signals as potentially meaningful or even problematic. And you can develop all kinds of symptoms and even panic attacks as a consequence.
Well, we're talking with Richie Davidson this hour. He is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison, and he is on the board of directors of the Mind and Life Institute, a group dedicated to promoting a dialogue between Western scientists and the Dalai Lama. And he's got a new book out that we're talking about today. It's called The Emotional Life of Your Brain. And we'll come back and take more phone calls, and you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about diving into our minds and our emotional lives with Richie Davidson. He's a neuroscientist at the UW-Madison, and his new book is called The Emotional Life of Your Brain. And let's answer, let's go to one of the emails now that we've gotten. This is from Cassidy, who says, has your research shed any light on how brains of people with pervasive developmental disability are functioning? I'm most interested in how emotions are experienced and processed in a child with Asperger's. I have a son with that diagnosis and can definitely see a difference in how he is emotionally and rationally compared to his more neurotypical younger brother.
Wonderful question. And we have conducted quite a bit of research on the autism spectrum disorders, and the social intuition style that I describe in the book is very much based upon the research that we've done in autism. This work has really focused on one of the key areas in which individuals on the autism spectrum seem to be different from neurotypical individuals, and that is in their ability to look at other people's faces and to extract emotional information from faces. One of the things that's been observed early on is that individuals on the spectrum don't have the same kind of gaze patterns when they scan a face. They don't look particularly at the eye region of the face, and the eye region of the face is a portion of the face which conveys a lot of emotional information. And so we have certain ideas based upon measurements of what's going on in the brain when they engage in this kind of task that lead us to understand better why individuals on the spectrum might avert their gaze when they're looking at a face. And so this, I think, can lead to the development of what I've called neurally inspired behavioral interventions, which I actually talk about in the last chapter of my book, that could be potentially helpful in working with kids with who are on the spectrum to help them better extract information from others using their nonverbal cues. So I think this is a very vibrant area of research, and I think we'll see over the next few years the development of training regimes that can be tried with these individuals to help improve certain aspects of their behavior.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that email, Cassidy. And a phone call next. Margaret is joining us from Whitewater. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I was wondering how all of this could tie in with the rehabilitation of criminals, because we seem to have such a lousy time doing it in this country. Would it work in a criminal way?
It's a great question, yeah. And you wonder about the teaching of compassion as maybe a component of that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. And there have been attempts to introduce certain kinds of meditation practices in the prison. I think that there is tremendous promise here. And there are some wonderful documentary films that have been made about this. There is a maximum security prison in the state of Alabama that was the focus of a documentary film called The Dahmer Brothers, which you can find online. It documents the impact of an intensive 10-day meditation retreat that was taught in the maximum security prison. And there was a book that was written based upon the letters of these prisoners. And right now, all we have is anecdotal information. But the anecdotal information, in my view, is quite persuasive in suggesting that these methods may be terrifically helpful with this population. And they're just, hanging out in prison, often not doing very much productive work in the first place. And so it's really in many ways an ideal environment in which to introduce these methods. And it's in the scheme of things, extremely inexpensive, and in the long run, maybe penny wise and pound foolish not to try.
Well, thank you for that question. And, it makes you think about how moving yourself around on these emotional style spectrums that benefits you, it would be nice to harness the brain to benefit the greater good, the world at large, in terms of compassion and willingness to help. I mean, can we build better people, more moral, caring people by working with the brain?
It's a wonderful question, and it's certainly my conviction that we can. I think that while each of us has the seeds of compassion within us, I think it's part of the human repertoire, very much like languages. But in order to speak and in order to be a language comprehending organism, we need to be raised in a linguistic community. And there are examples that have been written about of feral children who, because of unfortunate accidents, have not been raised in a linguistic community and never really learned to develop language. And I think the same is true of compassion. Mm. In order for compassion, for those seeds to be nurtured, we need to be raised in a compassionate environment. But when we are raised in that kind of compassionate environment, those seeds can flourish. And I think there are exercises that we can do as children and adults to help nourish these seeds and cultivate these qualities. And we're now doing work with children beginning in preschools. And we've developed a curriculum that we call the Kindness Curriculum, which is really based on some of these compassion meditation exercises, but they're taught in a completely secular way. And we're interested in determining whether we can nurture the seeds of compassion beginning very early in life to build better habits of mind.
Yeah, it's so interesting. So preschool, we're talking about 3 and 4-year-olds here. What are they doing? Are they imagining giving other kids their cookies or helping them when they fall down?
Well, some of it is actually specific behavioral exercises that involve cooperation and directly teaching them the benefits of cooperation and how certain tasks are much more readily and effectively completed when children cooperate. There are books that are used that are about this. There are age-appropriate books. And it's combined with mindfulness meditation exercises that can also be helpful in reinforcing these kinds of qualities. And the kids love it. They just glom onto this. In many ways, I think it's much easier to teach them because they have not been socialized like we are, to be more isolated. And they can, I think, more directly, experientially understand how they're all interdependent, that that how each of them treats others affects the well-being of the whole group.
I love that you're teaching preschoolers to meditate. I mean, you have to wonder, too, if you start out so young, to look at the example of 10,000 hours makes you a master at anything,
including, you know, say piano. You start when you're two. Are you you're a genius and you're a prodigy by the time you're grown up? Could the same work with compassion? You can be a compassion savant when you're older.
Well, it would be my aspiration to cultivate a generation of compassion savants. I think that the world would be a better place if we were able to do that.
Oh, I'd love to hear how this turns out as this goes further along. Let's see. We're running out of time, so let's go back to the phones. We have Eric joining us from Milwaukee. Hi there.
Hi. My my question was concerning to what extent that dietary habits may influence our emotional well-being in terms of nutritional deficiency versus, you know, optimal nutrition. And then I was also wondering, are there particular exercises that a parent can apply to, let's say, an eight-year-old daughter outside, not, you know, within the school setting, within the home? Is there certain things described in the book that a parent can apply outside the home with their child? And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the question. There's no question, I think, that food and what we eat will affect our brain and through that affect our emotions. And there are certain individuals, I think, that may be more sensitive to these kinds of influences. There's a new book which just came out written by a friend of mine who's a pediatric neurologist at Harvard Medical School by the name of Martha Herbert. And the book is called The Autism Revolution. And in that book, she describes how food may affect the symptoms of autism in autism spectrum children. And so I think that that's one example of dietary influences. With respect to parenting, there's a lot of evidence to indicate that the way a parent acts toward his or her offspring will affect the brains of those offspring. And, you know, I think that, again, there's no specific formula other than, I think, expressing kindness and compassion and love. And the Dalai Lama often talks about the seeds of compassion arising in the relationship between a parent and his or her children. That is where compassion is naturally most readily expressed. And if we can build on that and generalize to a wider group of individuals, I think that we can make our relationships more harmonious.
All right. Well, thank you much for that question. And let's do another email quickly. This is from Gloria in Muskego, who asks, for someone who's never meditated, what's a good way to start? Is there a simple and basic practice that is a good beginning point?
Great question. There is in my book, I describe some. If you go onto our website of our center, which is the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds, the website is investigatinghealthyminds.org. You will find some resources there. But there are lots of resources that are available. You can learn it at home. There are CDs available. There are websites. You can begin for just a few minutes a day, and every little bit can help.
Well, there are also dozens and dozens of different kinds of meditation. Now, you've worked, it sounds, primarily with Buddhists. Have you considered looking at other contemplative traditions?
Yes. We've actually worked with other contemplative traditions as well. We've done some work with yoga traditions that really come from Vedanta and Hindu practices. So there are lots of different practices, as you say, hundreds of them. And they don't all do the same thing. They produce somewhat different effects. They may share some elements in common, but there are also some differences. So I think it's important that a person find what feels right for them. Again, I don't think there's any one method that's going to be best for everyone.
Now, I've only got about 30, 40 seconds left for your answer, but what is your end goal in all of this? You've been working with the Dalai Lama. You've been bringing to light the effects that we can have on our brain and training compassion and some of these higher ideals as well. What would you like to see when your career is done in terms of brain research?
Well, I'd like to see this work really go out into the world. And The idea that we can all take more responsibility and change our own brains for the better, I think, can lead the world to a more hopeful and better place.
Mm. Well, thank you. That's a great place to leave it. It's been a delight talking to you this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Richie Davidson, our guest this morning. He is a neurologist at the UW-Madison, and he serves on the board of directors of the Mind and Life Institute, a group dedicated to promoting a dialogue between Western scientists and the Dalai Lama. And he's got a new book out, and we've been talking about it this hour. It is called The Emotional Life of Your Brain, that co-authored with Sharon Begley. And thank you to you for all of the questions and comments. And we'll have a little bit. There's more on our Facebook page, and we'll be posting a link to the documentary that was mentioned called The Dhamma Brothers. And in the meantime, I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.